Hi, I'm April Fulton, a health editor at NPR.
And I'm Giselle Grayson, a producer. And welcome to Your Health, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk here at NPR. This week, we are taking a look at the growing problem of tuberculosis in North Korea.
The perils of peewee hockey.
And my personal favorite, an uplifting piece by John Hamilton on some schools' efforts to prepare kids with autism for jobs once they graduate.
Well, since you happen to be married to John, I guess it's okay to call that one a favorite.
Yeah.
But first, Brenda Wilson has this report on how the Obama administration plans to help poor countries use aid dollars better by focusing on the health of moms and kids.
The Obama administration's Global Health Initiative would work with poor countries to create health systems tailored to their needs. There's a concern that other basic health needs have been neglected in favor of AIDS. Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health says that the initiative would provide $63 billion over 6 years.
Which is the largest amount of money that has ever been committed to any global health initiative. It isn't only HIV that is in that program. There's maternal health, child health, neglected tropical diseases, nutrition, malaria, etc.
The initiative preserves the Bush AIDS relief plan and adds funding and assistance for 9 countries to build up basic health systems, among them Bangladesh, Mali, and Ethiopia. The aim is to allow patients to get care at one location rather than having to seek care in different places. For example, family planning at one facility and HIV care at another. But what worries AIDS advocates like Mark Harrington is when you look at the administration's budget for HIV/AIDS, the increases in coming years are not as steep as in previous years.
The resources available that have been proposed and put on the table by the White House are totally, grossly insufficient to achieve the vision of the president's own global health initiative.
Even though 5 million people in developing countries are being treated now, millions more are waiting.
There are no resources in the world right now that are going to treat every single person who needs to be treated.
Again, NIH's Dr. Anthony Fauci.
We definitely need to do more. And let me go on the record. I'm in total favor of universal access for everyone who's infected, who needs to be on therapy. Is that going to be feasible given the current resources? No, it's not. So we have a problem, and I think to deny that there's a problem is being unrealistic.
But one country where health officials say they are already seeing the effects of the administration's slowdown in funding for HIV/AIDS is Uganda. The country was considered an HIV/AIDS model during the Bush administration, but it's not on the list of countries being phased into the Global Health Initiative. Uganda's Dr. Peter Mugenyi says he's disturbed by this shift in international health.
We still have a crisis in Africa. The crisis is not over. The emergency is not over. We are not able to treat all those people who are coming to us in need of treatment. So clinics are turning away patients.
Mugenyi says Uganda has 170,000 people on anti-AIDS drugs, less than half of the people who need treatment now. Those already on treatment will continue to get the medicines. Mugenyi says when one person in a family is getting the drugs and another is being turned away from clinics, families face painful choices.
A woman just returned the drugs to me. She said she couldn't take the drugs herself when the rest of her family could not access treatment.
Similar stories are being told by Doctors Without Borders of HIV patients turned away from clinics in Malawi, Kenya, and South Africa. Experts say that in many cases, it's not that AIDS drugs are in short supply. There's a lack of coordination among clinics that provide treatment, a problem the Global Health Initiative hopes to address. More details of the Global Health Initiative are expected to be announced soon. But already the administration is on the ground in countries, merging U.S. programs like maternal and child health, family planning, malaria, and AIDS. Because fewer staff are required, money is being saved that can be used to provide services elsewhere. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
So now we're going to take a look at another global health problem, tuberculosis. Many people in the U.S. don't even think about it as a public health threat, but in some countries it really is.
That's right. North Korea's got a big problem, and there's not a whole lot of infrastructure to deal with it. NPR's Mike Schuster has this report on the American Foundation leading the battle to fight the disease.
Probably no American has spent more time in North Korea over the past decade than Stephen Linton.
I've been introduced that way by government officials, so they probably know that answer better than I do.
Linton has been to North Korea more than 65 times. He is the chairman of the Eugene Bell Foundation, and his family traces its connection to Korea back to the 1890s. For the past 13 years, he has been working exclusively on combating tuberculosis. Over that time, he reckons he and his teams have diagnosed and treated 250,000 tuberculosis patients in North Korea. 3 years ago, doctors in North Korea began to notice that first and even second-line drugs were failing to control the epidemic. A strain of tuberculosis known as multi-drug-resistant TB had appeared, and the resource-starved North Korean health system was unable to cope.
They brought this issue up, and they encouraged us to do something about it. So we started a very small pilot project with 19 people in 2007. And over the next several years, this program grew as confidence in the program developed. And then it just last fall, it exploded.
Now Linton and his foundation are treating more than 600 North Korean patients for multi-drug-resistant TB. It's an arduous process. First, the patients must undergo sputum tests, which are carried back to South Korea for analysis. 5 or 6 months later, Linton returns with medication. The treatment for MDR-TB, as they call it, lasts for 2.5 years.
This is the first MDR-TB program that has ever taken place in North Korea. And it took us several years to win the confidence of the caregivers and of the patients in the program itself. And so I think what we saw last fall was that the word is now out. The stuff really works. These drugs work, and there is hope for people who have failed 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5 courses of regular TB medications.
One very cold day last November, Linton and his team arrived at the Nampo Care Center. The team wasn't expecting what they saw, says Sarah Carpenter, a teacher at the Seoul Foreign School who has been helping to raise money for the effort. On this trip to North Korea, Carpenter, a New Zealander, went along for the first time.
I do remember that day. It was very early, and I think that day Stephen was expecting 100 people to come for drug-resistant testing. And we got there, and it was a flood of people, and I would say 200 to 300 people turned up. None of those people we would even see if they hadn't failed treatment several times over.
All the students at the school pitch in to raise money, she says. This year their goal was $12,000. They raised more than $40,000. Linton and the foundation made a short video about their visit to Nampo last November. There, explains the video, they encountered a familiar face, Dr. Kim Young-sun, someone they had worked with for years.
Having treated TB patients for the last 15 years, Dr. Kim contracted the disease himself 3 years ago. His daughter, Eunju, has also contracted TB after spending much of her childhood living near the care center. She is suffering from tuberculosis of the larynx and has lost her voice.
The daughter, who looks to be about 11, is asked, what kind of food do you like? She whispers the answer, I like all kinds.
So Winnaju contracted TB and she had to have surgery and it removed her larynx so she can't talk and she breathes through a tube and they think she has it again.
Right now, prospects for the program are uncertain. The standoff between North and South Korea over the torpedo attack on the South Korean naval vessel Cheonan caused the South Korean government to reevaluate all of its humanitarian aid efforts in North Korea. Linton fears that could have a serious impact on the campaign to combat multi-drug-resistant TB.
The sad thing about this is that once you develop the resistance, it's not just your problem. You pass that resistance on to anyone else who's infected from you. So obviously we need to make sure that there's a constant flow of medication, whatever the political and diplomatic situation is at the time, and we're just hopeful we can continue to do this.
If there is an interruption in their treatment, patients could die and pass the strain on to others before they do. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Seoul.
Now we turn to the very real risks of body checking for little kids playing hockey. April, I'm a football fan. Though I have 2 sons, this worries me. What is body checking?
Well, as Allison Aubrey explains in our next piece, it's basically a strategic way of getting the puck back by slamming your opponent into the wall. It's what the pros do, and it's what little kids want to do, too.
That sounds really dangerous.
There is a big risk of head injuries, so let's listen.
There's one move in hockey that's at the center of the controversy, the body check. And if you want to understand just how powerful one can be, consider this moment from an NHL playoff game a few years back. The Buffalo Sabres' RJ Umberger had just received the puck from behind him when Philadelphia Flyers player Brian Campbell caught him off guard and slammed into him.
Flyers looking to respond. Oh! Campbell just destroyed Umberger!
In the stadium, the fans went wild, and on the ice, a brawl ensued as Umberger laid on his back receiving medical help.
Brian Campbell absolutely cold-cocked RJ Umberger.
When Umberger gazed up from the ice, it was with the kind of woozy look that showed he wasn't just down. He was in trouble.
It's a dramatic hit, yeah, and he looks like he got a concussion. But you get several of those a year in the National Hockey League, for sure.
Barry Willer is a concussion prevention researcher at the University of Buffalo. He's also a hockey fan and played the game recreationally. He says despite these dramatic plays, the body check is integral to the sport. During competitive, collegiate, and professional games, there can be dozens of checks and no one gets hurt. But this takes skill, and it takes young players time to develop it.
So when should the youngster learn to body check and, to, more importantly, to take a check? That's the controversial issue.
11 is the age that leagues across the U.S. typically introduce the body check. But a big new study suggests that this may be too young. Researchers found that 11-year-olds who played in a hockey league in Alberta, Canada, that allowed body checking were much more likely to end up with concussions and severe injuries than the same-aged kids who played on a different league that bans checking.
I guess what surprised me was the magnitude of the effect.
Allison McPherson is a professor at York University in Toronto. She was not involved in this new study, but her own research points to similar conclusions.
The kids who played in Alberta were almost four times as likely to have an injury compared to kids who played in Quebec. Oh,
wow, so almost 400% more likely to end up injured. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a big difference.
So how serious are these injuries? David Hovda directs the UCLA Brain Injury Research Center. He says, generally speaking, athletes usually recover well after a first concussion. But the bigger risk comes when players return to the game too early.
During the time that the brain is trying to recover from the first concussion, we call that a period of cellular vulnerability or brain vulnerability. And when that happens, the brain now can be really severely damaged.
The new study, pointing to the specific risks of body checking, has the sport really debating possible changes to league rules. Kevin McLaughlin is senior director for hockey development at USA Hockey.
I think this new information will definitely play a factor with our board of directors and our district representatives in their consideration for when is the right age to implement body checking.
The group just wrapped up its annual meeting this weekend in Colorado Springs, and McLaughlin says there's been plenty of debate on the issue, but he says his group needs time to review all the facts.
At the end of the day, it's our number one priority is the safety of the youth athlete, because we don't want anybody getting hurt playing the game.
McLaughlin says the earliest any policy change would be made is next summer. In the interim, USA Hockey says it will continue to focus on educating coaches on the best ways to help players develop proper checking skills, while at the same time trying to keep them safe. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
And now we turn to a sobering thought. Nearly as many American troops have committed suicide this year as have been killed in combat in Afghanistan. NPR's Jamie Terabay has more on why this might be happening and what the Army is doing about it.
Edward Colley has told the story of his son's suicide so often, he sounds almost matter-of-fact.
I'm Ed Colley. I'm the father of Stephen Colley, Private First Class in the United States Army. Stephen committed suicide in 3 years ago in May of 2007.
The last time Colley saw his son was at a family gathering in April 2007. Stephen, a helicopter mechanic, had been back in the country for about 5 months since a tour in Iraq. Colley says Stephen was detached. He spent the days watching cartoons. He fought with his wife.
When they went back to Texas, she never went home with him. She went to her parents' house, and he went back to work.
From there, it was a downhill stumble, struggling in a work environment an army investigation later called hostile. On May 16, 2007, home alone, Stephen Colley argued with his wife through text messages. Edward Colley says at one point, his son asked her if there was rope in the storage shed.
He had texted his wife that suicide was an option. She immediately called the appropriate folks at the base, but Stephen, unfortunately in this case, Stephen was a very, very smart boy, and he had figured out how to make sure that nobody else would interfere with his plan.
The plan was to overdose on medication and then hang himself from a tree. He was 22 years old. The military ruled his death a suicide. But for Edward Colley, the hardest thing about his son's death is he believes it could have been prevented. The day before he killed himself, Stephen Colley took an army mental health assessment. Multiple choice questions, including some about intent to harm yourself. There were four possible answers.
And he picked the most severe, that he was thinking about committing suicide more than half the time.
And instead of acting on that information, the social worker who did Stephen Colley's assessment put him down for a sleep study in 3 weeks' time. The Army's own investigation said the established procedures failed to address his mental condition. Quote, if PFC Colley was admitted to the emergency room following the mental screening, it's unlikely the suicide would have occurred.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's my pleasure to welcome you once again to the April Senior Review Group.
Every month, Army leaders meet at the Pentagon to review the suicide numbers. There were 197 Army suicides in 2008, according to the Army's own figures. It includes active and non-active duty soldiers. That was the first time the Army rate exceeded the national average suicide rate. Last year, that number was 245. This year, through May, it's already 163. The Army has instituted all manner of programs to counsel and train soldiers. Stephen Colley had himself undergone suicide prevention training, yet the suicides continue.
We have 45 active duty suicides, we have 13 confirmed and 32 pending.
General Peter Corelli, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff, heads the monthly meeting. The group looks into every investigation. There's no main cause. For every PTSD-suffering soldier who takes his own life, there's a young recruit who's never been deployed, moves to a new unit, and can't handle it. There's no simple answer.
It doesn't exist.
Colonel Chris Philbrick heads the Army's Suicide Prevention Task Force.
The trends that we see are white male, but most of the Army is made up of white males. We see young soldiers. Most of the Army is made up of young soldiers. So as quickly as you could point at something, you can then come back and say, but that's who we are.
There may be no obvious patterns, but there are warning signs. And hindsight reveals so much. Throughout that two-hour Army review meeting, detail upon detail present portraits of troubled men. One soldier was on at least 12 different medications. Another was in relationship counseling and had severe alcoholism issues. One soldier was diagnosed with both depression and bipolar disorder, was medicated, and then deployed to Iraq. At that example, General Corelli is visibly angry. Later, he says one of the theories behind the high number of suicides is one of the most obvious, the endless deployments.
I think that you'd have to have your head buried in the sand to not think that a lot of them come out of 8.5 years of war.
Another theory, soldiers in transition, moving from a combat zone to back home, for example, are at risk. Many cases appear to involve both alcohol and overdose of medication, and for the most part, they speak to the Army's inability to deal with mental health issues.
Absolutely. Guilty as charged.
Colonel Philbrick slaps his hand on his desk.
I'm certain that there are soldiers that we did not properly treat in the long period of time since we started combat operations, that if we had done a better job and had been able to recognize that, wouldn't be where they're at today in Walter Reed and on a street corner somewhere because they haven't been taken care of.
Philbrick says the Army took too long to recognize it had a crisis on its hands. And he says it was dismissive.
What did we do? What did the Army normally do when there was soldiers with problems we didn't understand? thank you for your service, go find someplace else to work. We're making those changes.
Those changes include a 5-year, $60 million study with the National Institute of Mental Health. There are online programs designed to test emotional, mental, and social fitness. The Army says screening methods are as strict as they could ever be. Military psychiatrist Stephen Zanakis, a retired brigadier general, says there's more that needs to be done.
There's a whole culture change that would really need to occur at the bases here in the United States. And it may not be for 2 or 3 years till we really recognize that.
Recognize that change must happen in the unit, not just in the Pentagon. Zanakis also recommends tracking things like DUIs, discipline problems, things that could be potential red flags, the sorts of things that might have alerted commanders to Stephen Colley's situation.
It's a great system, and properly done, saves lives.
That's Stephen's father, Edward Colley. He's retired Air Force and Army. He has 2 other children in the military, and he and his wife have 3 more younger kids.
Mom prohibits the younger ones from joining the military now. You might understand that prohibition now in our house.
Even after the death of his son, Edward Colley doesn't blame the Army, but he wants it to learn and do better with someone else's child. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
Now, on a somewhat lighter note, we know that people with autism face a lot of challenges, and one of them is finding jobs. And once they find them, it's even harder for them to keep them. But some schools are really trying to help. John Hamilton visited a family who attends one of these schools, and he has the story.
A few years ago, things weren't looking good for Kevin Sargent. Even his mother, Jennifer Sargent, wasn't very hopeful.
He was pretty much a broken child, the way I would describe it. We really didn't see that he would be able to go to college, even have a job. That just wasn't in our future for him.
I was very articulate, which was the weird thing, but, you know, I'd always have my head in my jacket and my hood up, and I wouldn't want to talk to anybody just because I didn't know what they were going to do. I'd always play with my Legos, and, you know, I was rude all the time, and I had fits of anger and stuff like that just because I didn't understand people.
Jennifer Sargent took him in for testing and found out he had autism. That meant Kevin was eligible for special services. And his mother fought hard to get him into a school program at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, which specializes in kids with autism and other disorders or disabilities. It's also one of the places that devotes a lot of time to preparing its students for jobs. 6 years later, Kevin is a lot more social, he's a good student, and he's working as an intern in the IT department at the Parks and People Foundation. On this day, he's helping Jean DuBose set up a video presentation she's going to give to the foundation's board.
Can we run it again just to...
If it's a WMV file, that means that it downloaded to the computer, so now we should be able to play it offline if I can find the file.
Okay.
This is our part.
This is my part.
Kevin says computers are a good fit for him.
When you click something... Something happens, and it happens for an exact reason, and, you know, there's no guesswork with people. Sometimes I'm not able to read facial expressions or take, you know, nonverbal cues or something.
But Kevin needed a lot of help turning his love for computers into a marketable skill. Derek Glosser is the principal of Kennedy Krieger High School. He says the process began several years ago when Kevin was required to choose 1 of 5 industries to focus on as part of his education.
He chose information technology. And after his freshman year, has had information technology courses as part of his daily schedule.
Learning about computers and software was the easy part. Glosser says the program also taught Kevin skills that can be especially hard for people with autism.
Being able to accept directions from supervisors, work with colleagues, complete tasks, follow through on checklists, show up on time, dress appropriately.
The internship at Parks and People has been a sort of final exam for Kevin. And Jean DuBose says he's aced
it. It's been a pleasure having him. He's been great. He's quiet, but he works very hard, and we've enjoyed having him here.
And Kevin says it's helped him to realize he really does have job skills that people need.
I still have problems in some areas, like with anxiety and sometimes depression, but yeah, I've definitely come a long way, and I'm a lot happier.
As for Kevin's mother, Jennifer Sargent, nowadays she tends to say things about her son's future that make him squirm.
Oh, the sky's the limit. the limit is his limit, I guess. It's how far he wants to go.
Kevin Sargent graduated from Kennedy Krieger High School last week. He'll start at Montgomery College this fall. Eventually, Kevin hopes to design computer games. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And finally, April, you write for our blog called Shots, and you did a couple of pieces about how the government is making sure that the seafood coming out of the Gulf is safe. Is it safe?
Well, they say it's safe. I talked to the top seafood guys at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that's NOAA to you, and the FDA about their efforts, and they seem pretty confident that what they're doing is gonna keep people from eating bad fish.
You know, one issue that keeps coming up is about these dispersants that are also in the water, the chemicals that are used to break up the oil.
Well, that's right. And there's a lot of discussion about whether breathing in those chemicals are causing a problem or not. But my question for the FDA guys was whether it gets into the fish and then we eat it and ingest it that way. So the acting director of FDA's food safety operations, Don Kramer, told me that there's something about the fish's skin that blocks it from absorbing those dispersants into the flesh. So here's how he put it.
They may be in the gut. They may be on the gills, they may be on the surface, but they're not in the part of the fish that's consumed.
Well, that's good news. And you can find more of these interviews on our health blog called Shots. And for more health stories, like the unexplained link between diabetes and cancer,
and why super tasters love salt, go to npr.org/shots. That's all for your health this week. I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Giselle Grayson. Thanks for listening.